Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis and today I'm with Pete. How are you doing today?
Wonderful. How about yourself, sir?
Not too bad. Not too bad. So today I asked you on just because of your experience in Ukraine and specifically the maritime kind of experience. But since this is the first time on the podcast, would you mind doing a quick introduction to yourself?
Of course. My name is Pete. I spent about 8+ years in United States Navy Special Warfare as a SWCC medic. Ended up going through the SOCM portion of on the Army side back in 2015, crossing into 2016. Did my military career with Special Boat Team 22, deployed several times in support of counterterrorism, counter-narcotics terrorism operations. Ended up leaving the military about 3 years ago now. I worked a little bit of contracting work throughout Africa and then ended up going to Ukraine about 10 days into the conflict, working with an NGO called Global Surgical Medical Support Group. Ended up staying for about 2 years, and then am on and off, in and out there as well. Through GSMSG, I was the director of forward operations, so caught all of the other soft trainers that were coming in. And then, yes, sir, that about does it.
Perfect, perfect. And as much as it pains me to ask somebody from NSW any kind of medical questions, I got to admit, you have the experience. So,
thank you very much.
So, kind of jumping into it, you know, the maritime experience, you know, it's just a different environment, no different than the Arctic or the jungle or the mountains, the desert. It's got its own unique problem sets with it. So. You know, even if it's just planning a mission going across open water, you know, how do you plan for something like that? What kind of gear prep, anything like that?
Yeah, yes, sir. So the way that we end up kind of looking at it is, so we have the tactical portion, that being the bullets, the tactical medicine, the stuff like that. And then unfortunately as well, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, when it comes to the maritime platform, you're also looking at you being your own extraction platform as well. So beyond the medicine, now we're looking at weighing the medical aspects versus the necessity for speed when it comes to extraction. Very similar to all the guys who have ever worked dust off, anything like that. The idea of having this platform for which you can use to extract patients is wonderful until you're in a sea state or in a river state going around curves and bends or hitting waves and stuff like that, while also trying to maintain vital signs, stick a patient, do drug math, anything like that. And as we were talking about before, now you're talking about incorporating the wetness, the dark, an unstable platform when you're trying to keep a hold of your patient. So the biggest thing that I enforced on my new guys when they did become come into the maritime medicine, become boat guy medics, was a lot of the stuff that we talked about at JSOM TC. Just that there is no cookie cutter scenario when it comes to doing the real medicine. I would try to make it as realistic as possible in terms of interjecting these difficulties that you're going to see. For example, opening an IV starter kit. That's great when you are in a warm, dry, safe environment, when you're treating a patient on the front of that boat, whether it be the rib, the Soc R, or a Zodiac, you go to open that thing up, and then the next thing you know, three quarters of your supplies is about 100 yards behind you because you're going fast and they caught that wind. So when we get down into the minute specifics of really doing medicine on it, having those touch points, but then in terms of maybe taping everything that you have to open, all of the same stuff that we were all taught in JSON-TC, but then just developing a self-reliance when it comes to being able to do it yourself and not trusting anything electronic, not trusting anything that you would look for audibly or without the use of red light as well. So it really just kind of takes that very fun high-speed medicine that we're all used to and grasping it when it's available in that sedentary or when you're holding still, but then understanding the fact that maybe that breath rate does come from asking your patient simply if he's having any trouble breathing, because you're not going to be able to hear those breath sounds. You're not going to be able to get that heart rate. That SpO2 is going to be really sketchy. So hopefully that answers your questions. I know I kind of covered a wide array of things there. But.
No, absolutely. I mean, definitely from the training aspect, I think being in the environment and being in the conditions, even if they're maybe not actual combat conditions, but at least close as you can to training, that this is real. Opening those packages when your hands are cold and wet gets a lot harder than, you know, you're at the schoolhouse and everything's nice and dry and warm. So there's some tips of the trade that go with any kind of environment. And I think that's kind of a detriment on ourselves when we don't train like that, because you're essentially training yourself to fail, I think.
Yeah, I would completely agree. And back at the boat teams, I'm sure you've seen them, but the vibration negating stethoscopes that have the Bluetooth attachments, coolest thing ever in the world when those came out. But now to take that boat medicine and apply it to the peer near peer aspect, we can't be relying on Bluetooth now in situations where entire areas are jammed up or that Bluetooth signature is too much of a telltale sign due to its it being the only thing out there that's creating this type of signature. So I think with maritime medicine, and then especially trying to combine the two worlds of the peer near peer aspect and the dirty, disgusting, wet medicine that maritime is, it really just does revert back to those physical findings and being reliant on what you're seeing and what your patient's telling you, as opposed to necessarily what your instruments could potentially be telling you, because it's only a matter of time until a lot of these things are going to be very not usable anymore.
Yeah. So when it comes to like a specific mission, obviously you're going to know, you know, transit time, like from my launch point to where we're, my insertion point is going to be.
Yes, sir.
So that's, you're going to have to figure that into your planning, right? Especially on the coming back, you may be coming back with some kind of casualties. Does that factor in as far as gear wise? Like, hey, I know it's going to be, I'm just making up a number, it's going to be 4 hours, you know, crossing open water. You know, I'm going to have 4 hours worth of narcotics. I'm going to have 4 hours worth of, you know, blood or fluids, or whatever, you know what I mean?
So with that, in an ideal world, yes. Unfortunately, especially when it comes to the maritime aspect, the CASAVAC ideation or the medevac ideation kind of comes secondary to the fact that it's a floating fighting platform. So I can request all the blood in the world, all the narcotics in the world, all of the different prolonged field care-ish equipment in the world. But at the end of the day, you are still dealing with a very minimized platform, something that movement is already, you cannot move around on those things once you're transporting packs. And then if you're actually looking at fighting your way out as well, you generally kind of have your standard loadout in terms of the same thing that we advertised with leaving JSON TC. I could take care of one or two patients, urgent patients, pretty comfortably. But once we get beyond that, now we're pushing the limit of what I can comfortably carry in there. And again, those boats are designed, or the maritime aspect is, we're designed to get ourselves out of there first. We're designed to get away from the contact as quickly as possible. And then the medicine kind of falls in after that, which is a very unfortunate aspect. But when it comes to speed, maneuverability, those are going to outweigh the fact that I'm hoping to be able to keep my patient comfortable the entire time.
Okay. So essentially you're going with what you carry on your back?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Okay.
Well, so we have what we carry on our back. And then additionally, particularly within the NSW crafts, we will have a roll down, kind of a built out truck bag, if you will. But beyond that, you know, now we're really starting to play with crew maneuverability, operator maneuverability, and then craft speed as well. So when it comes to that ideation of keeping it as a medevac or CASVAC platform, you are still kind of constrained within keeping it a fighting, floating platform as well.
Okay. Now, I know just from a little bit of experience, there's definitely spots within the hull of whatever craft you were operating in that are at least a little bit more stable and less moving than other parts of the boat. So, do you guys build training around that? Like, hey, you know, keep the patient essentially next to the keel as close as you can so you're not moving as much type things?
Yeah, absolutely. And generally that sweet spot is behind the coxswain station, kind of back over the engine compartment. It's once you start looking at the turning axis of that boat, it's kind of in the center point. And then additionally, as that boat rises and falls as well, that's kind of where you can get a sweet spot for treating your patient. Generally, the rule of thumb is to let the new guys figure it out on their own, which leads to a very miserable, yep. I know that you're familiar with the teaching aspects of medicine. Leads to a very miserable transport time for the patient as they're either eating wind up on the front while the medic is trying to figure out why all of his gear is gone because it's floating in the water behind you. Yeah. As that boat rises and falls going 50 kph. So generally that sweet spot is kind of towards the middle, but the new guys figure that out very quickly. That being said as well, especially when it comes to the NSW craft, something that has to be taken into factor is the fact that those things are not designed to move your standard litters. So again, I'll let them, generally we let them choose their litter platform, whether it be Skedco, Foxtrot, Talon, anything like that. But also generally you do end up with the side of that boat being right here and that patient being dangled outward as you're trying to move them around. And so I'm all for, getting a little bit creative in terms of, I've seen water wings attached to the patient. I've seen water wings attached to the Skedco or the Talon itself up around the head. When we were teaching these classes operationally to the Ukrainians, it was much more interesting because they did not have that background, that bona fides that they could swim. Mm-hmm. So it became very apparent to these guys very quickly that this was a necessary thing to take into consideration. At least with the NSW guys, there's a feeling of comfort in the water.
Yeah.
Not so much with the Ukrainians. So that was a very good thing to see as well.
Okay. So I guess when it comes to litter setup, I guess what do you like using in a given craft that you would normally use?
That Skedco is always the go-to with between the maneuverability, the pliable platform on it, being able to take those corners, given of course, patient severity, mm-hmm. being able to bend the patient a little bit if need be. And then, the standard SOP as well is to throw those water wings up around the head with the idea that if it starts getting too sketchy, just go ahead and pull those preemptively. If we're transporting the patient and there's any sort of possibility that they could touch water, because a lot of those crafts are not designed to go to 0 centimeters, right? We're still having to transport. Go ahead and pop the water wings. I understand that it's a tactical pause. I understand it's tactically not sound, but the last thing we want to do is have a guy strapped into his own straitjacket and given a wound set or not. Now we're talking about a very dangerous situation.
Yeah.
Involves guys getting in the water. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the litter as far as prepping. Imagine, like you said, you know, if it's starting to get sketchy, you pop the water wings as far as preparing a patient for travel. Those things are not smooth at all going across water. So how do your narcotics usage change? Do you find you have to dose the patient a little bit heavier?
Actually, generally, pending patient severity, of course, but, given the fact that we are still, even if we are out of a tactical scenario, we're in a situation where the patient has to be able to potentially fend for themselves. It's very difficult to take full ownership of the patient unless it is completely required. So I kind of lean almost a little bit more towards underdosing. Okay. Again, pending patient severity.
Sure.
And then trying to keep that patient, at least with their own self-preservation instincts. I totally understand the fact that we're talking about pain, we're talking about, but when it comes to maybe that survivability rate being the patient remembers to breathe and take a big deep breath should they feel cold water versus completely snowing them to the fact where now I'm dealing with taking over the respiratory drive, ensuring that they aren't doing something stupid in an altered state of consciousness and an already very, very dynamic platform. I would err towards the side of caution, just mitigating that pain level, keeping them under that 8 mark, but trying to keep them somewhat coherent to keep working with you and to better their own survivability rate, better their own situation as well.
Okay. And kind of the idea is, like you said, self-preservation, but also my lack of ability to monitor the patient. Exactly. Because of vibration, because of noise, et cetera. Hopefully they're able to do things more on their own.
Exactly. And I hate to use the old nomenclature, but when we were taught what's the quickest way to clear an airway, if your patient's screaming in pain, quickest way to make sure that my patient's still with me is, you know, not registering that pain response, but man, if I can keep him talking to me, and especially if I can tell him like, man, just please hold on to this. If you do not feel comfortable, let me know. If you feel like something is changing, let me know. Because just on those mobile platforms, pending the depth of the water, pending the situation, it's really difficult taking that semi-coherent patient who could potentially save his own life despite the level of pain and then taking full ownership for him before we get to that point where, all right, we are within 90% certainty in a clear zone. Let's go ahead, take care of this pain completely. I got you. You know, and we can go ahead and snow you or take away that pain completely, if you will.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier, you know, you've had some real world experiences and other guys around you having some real world experiences, you know, going over water, doing operations and having to come back. So would you mind walking me through one or two of those?
Absolutely. So without delving too much into the operational side of things, a point that was brought up to me by one of my coastal friends was that in terms of my aspect, being down at 22, we were the riverine team. So we were the big guns, moving around the corners very quickly. But an aspect that my friend brought up when it came to a boat collision that hit the news pretty heavily about a couple of years ago regarding a training situation as well, but was the fact that when it comes to that depth level, when we're dealing with that deep water, when we're not necessarily extracting someone off of the beach, that those guns, those miniguns, the 240s and stuff like that, that's not what we're worried about. Everyone talks about the fire off the beach, potentially the boats shooting each other, things like that. And then we start to lose the fact that you are dealing with a very, very heavy machine that you cannot stop on a dime, that is taking these very evasive maneuvers very quickly. And so what ended up happening was they had a boat-on-boat collision, and the ground force commander that was within the boat ended up having the boat right alongside of him, compound fractures in both legs, and then ended up with a severe head injury as well. So now they are in the middle of the channel where they can't go boots dry, anything like that, with a boat that's sinking and another boat that's incapacitated and a patient that requires extraction. So very much so to your point that you were talking about earlier, where we have these cookie cutter scenarios where we drive off and then get picked up by this medical vessel or have the helicopter come in and take this patient off. It's not realistic in a lot of the situations. And so this led to an extract of the patient who was hemodynamically unstable, in shock. You're dealing with open compound fractures in the leg with arterial involvement or potential for arterial involvement. And we start looking at this situation where now we can't do this perfect cross-decking of a patient. We're talking about extracting a guy out of freezing water in a channel that we don't know the depth. And so for him, it just became a very a clear example that these wonderful situations where you receive the patient and then you receive a patient turnover is not the case. You're ending up going into the water and then pulling this guy out based off of the fact that we're not training for these high speed collisions. We're training for these gunshot wounds, these blast wounds and stuff like that. But we still have vessels that are going 80 kilometers per hour around each other into turns and then end up colliding. So maybe the lean towards this tactical aspect of gunshot wounds and explosions is wonderful, and it's very helpful for the tactical side of things. But forgetting that we're dealing with these gigantic moving platforms has to be more of a reminder, or has to be something in the back of our minds more so as we prepare these guys for maritime involvement.
Yeah, I mean it's really not that much harder to set up scenarios like that versus gunshot wounds and things like that. It's blunt trauma.
Absolutely. They're just not as sexy. And you have to admit the fact that something bad happened on our end, which yep. I think as all special operators have, it's a tough pill to swallow to admit that there's a high potential for the fact that these things that we're in charge of could crash into each other.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Sir.
I mean, reality bites everybody, you know? And like you said, like it's not that much more difficult to train that type of scenario versus anything else. It's just acknowledging that this is a reality, looking at history of things that constantly happen, you know, as far as training accidents or just operational accidents happen.
Just of course.
Incorporate and those.
Even with the people that I've taken on are thousands and thousands of Ukrainians that I've taught. The vast majority of the feedback that I've gotten from the T-Tri-C aspects have been people who have dealt with this everyday car accident. It's a much higher likelihood within the Ukrainian civilian populace that they're in a car accident as opposed to the dramatic explosion or anything like that. The military guys, it's a totally different story. However, I think the level of acceptance or being able to accept that the likelihood of a car accident, or as you were talking about before, the likelihood of boats colliding, for the most part, is a much higher probability than taking that 50 cal round, taking those shots off the shore. And I think in the boat guy and the maritime community, just being able to take that step backwards and saying, look, maybe this is what we need to be aiming our training towards a little bit more as well, it would go a long ways.
Okay. So you had mentioned earlier, you're involved at least in training the Ukrainians, training other people as far as medical aspects, I'm guessing on the maritime side of things, you know, how do you look at incorporating the training that they need and in probably a very truncated period of time?
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Yeah. So I think the level of acceptance in terms of what you're giving them was a very, it was a hard pill for me to swallow. However, once I was able to accept the fact that I cannot take these guys that are supposed to go towards the front line and give them all this wealth of knowledge, it doesn't matter how much I like them. It doesn't matter how sharp they are. I have to break that 3-month training block down that I would love to give them. And I got to give it to them in 5 days. So now what are we talking about here? What wave tops can I take? Obviously tourniquets. And when I first went to Ukraine, you know, over 2 years ago now, the vast majority of them hadn't even heard of tourniquets to that point. So if I could, earlier on, if I could get them to a point where they were at least proficient with a tourniquet, understanding what right looked like, and then sending them off even with that, I felt like I had done my job. But expectation management and making sure that I can see what wave tops are necessary to hit before shipping them off. Otherwise, you just end up with this conglomeration of they know how to put a tourniquet on. They heard something about needle decompression. They don't know what a needle decompression is. It goes somewhere here where there's also a lot of other
right.
very vital things. So expectation management and then learning how to drill home the real things that could potentially save their lives and save their buddies' lives was huge for me. And I think was very efficient and a turning point in what we were able to do for the Ukrainians as well.
Cool. So another thing, especially you mentioned tourniquets, fairly popular lately as sure. far as saying, you know, we've gone too far. Tourniquets are not saving that many people. In fact, we're losing limbs because of it. So essentially the same arguments we had 2000
right.
The U.S. had, now it's happening in Europe. Like, why is this even a problem?
Yeah. And it really pains me, especially from having been a part of the T-Tri-C community for so long and seeing these leaps and bounds that we finally were making, you know, in terms of the recognition of tourniquet importance, to see pushback coming. And so the evidence against the tourniquets is completely stemming from the fact that they are understanding that it's a tourniquet. And they're understanding that it should go on, but with total lack of understanding of how the tourniquets work, why the tourniquets are being placed, what massive bleeding is, what right looks like. Similar to a lot of things that are occurring within Ukraine, I think that they are just getting things shoved at them. They're going from zero, let's call it, from before, being having no tourniquet understanding. And then they're being shoved into this level of T-Tri-C understanding that the rest of the world wants them to be without the training steps that I took being, okay, let's talk about tourniquets. This is what we have. This is the danger of putting a tourniquet on. We can talk about conversions. We can talk about approximation. They didn't have the luxury of that. And they didn't have the luxury of having this data accumulate over time. They were told, tourniquets are good. Put them on when you're bleeding. Okay, cool. I'm bleeding. I got to put this thing on. Now we're dealing with partial application or unnecessary application entirely due to a lack of understanding and a lack of training value when it comes to them. So they did not have that warming up phase. It just went from 0 to 100. And I think due to the high patient count and the high statistics that you see coming out of there, you just have these guys that have absolutely zero training, and then now have this new thing thrown at them in a very large quantity without the cooking time necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think it's 100% a training problem. Mm-hmm. And I think one, it's easy to be to Monday morning quarterback. You know, this guy lost his leg because of a tourniquet application, forgetting that the medic who put it on was in the middle of an artillery attack that lasted, 6 hours. Mm-hmm. What do we want this guy to do? He's barely holding on to life as it is.
Absolutely. And if we're, this sounds like a generalization, but if we're resorting back into the fact that if you put a tourniquet on, then that means that the limb is lost, but we're preserving life. Isn't that what we dealt with initially when we decided that tourniquets were worth it? And yes. Then we built from there. As combat medics, we learned about, like we talked about, the approximation and the conversion. That's great. But the reason, or our understanding of tourniquets was based off of the fact that when we put them on, he's probably going to lose the limb, but that's okay because he lived. And now we're kind of reverting back to that being unacceptable.
Yeah.
So, I think that it will start coming a lot further, with the more understanding that the Ukrainians have and the more ability that we have to train them on them. But I think jumping to this conclusion of Ukraine is proving that tourniquets don't work is a vast, or that tourniquet application is a bad idea is a vast generalization.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating to see, really.
Yeah. And I think, and absolutely, the world is learning a lot about tactics and procedures and things that work and things that don't work especially on the tactical side, from Ukraine, from Israel, from all over the place. And so the whole world is, ears wide open. However, I think they're almost taking the word for it a little bit too rapidly, for their own good, if that makes any sense.
I completely agree. It's that headline. You read the headline and then you jump to conclusions without a full understanding. No, I completely agree with you. But I think especially with the amount of resources that are being dumped in terms of NGOs like GSMSG, and then Atlas is another one that's doing huge things for the Ukrainians as well in terms of providing these high quality training sessions, and then actually going forth and then overseeing. Now we're getting into blood transfusions and stuff like that as well. I think that the same way that the US did, the more practical application, the more understanding of what right looks like, the better feedback that we're going to be able to get. So.
Yeah. Perfect. Perfect. Is there, when it comes to maritime, the medical side of maritime operations, is there anything, if you could give advice to a young man or woman who's going into this environment, they have their whatever medical training they've received, how is maritime different and how can I be successful in this environment?
Absolutely. And it really does go back. I know I keep making references to JSON TC, but the different things that were taught there stood out and then kind of made me into the medic that, or the my own medical mold of what I tried to hold for myself and then tried to allow my new guys to create as well. But resorting back to that fact that sometimes medicine is a very ugly, your instruments are not working. You have to constantly be trying to fight against something to improve your battle position, your fighting position, especially with maritime, due to the fact that it is a mobile platform. You're constantly fighting against something to try to better your patient's survivability rate. So lack of acceptance that this is the best that you can do, and then constantly looking for a different way to do it, a way to improve your patient's survivability. No matter what the sea state is, no matter what lumination you're working with, no matter what has failed or what instrument you have that's failed, I think just constantly reattacking, whether that comes in the phase of reassessment or you recognize that something is not going to work before you've even done it. Okay, cool. What is something else that we can do? Work it on the fly. Just fight for your patient.
Perfect. Hey, thank you, Pete. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Really appreciate what you do.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Every boy is waiting there for you.